The hour of 1 o'clock having arrived, I'm going to call the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. Well, welcome to the interim. This is the first of a series of hearings we're going to have as a thorough review of the higher education budget that was passed and signed last session. The first hearing will have the University of Minnesota. Interim President Ettinger, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Chair Pawlowski. My name is Jeffrey Ettinger. I'm the interim president of the University of Minnesota, and I really appreciate having this opportunity before you and the committee here today. I want to express our gratitude for being here. It's an honor to be able to speak on behalf of the university. I also want to take a chance, if I could, to recognize some of the members of our University of Minnesota Board of Regents who are here with us today. So we have Regent Mike Kenyanya, Regent James Farnsworth, Regent Mary Turner, and I believe Regent Penny Wheeler. There she is. Great. Thanks. We also have faculty liaison Donna Spanis Martin, and I think he's going to be going to class and arriving more at the last minute, but student body president Shashank Morali will also be joining us today. And then we have several other folks from the university as well.
So, President Ettinger, you're saying that we should hope there should be at the November 6th meeting as many trustees as there were regents today?
Of course.
Okay, good. I agree with you.
I wanted to start, if I could, as somebody coming new to the university in the interim role here starting in June and really having a perspective more as sort of a member of the state community, if you will, it's really been interesting to see the dual nature of the University of Minnesota as having both an element of national excellence but also a critical statewide impact. Indeed, the University of Minnesota Twin Cities is one of the top 25 public research institutions in the country. For the second year in a row, we've earned over $1 billion in research awards, and that translates directly into innovation and technology commercialization opportunities. We are national leaders in a wide array of fields, including medicine, medical devices, agriculture, food safety, natural resources, and transportation, just to name a few. Beyond these rankings, our work at the university saves lives and makes lives better. We hope we're educating the next generation of Minnesota's leaders in critical and emerging disciplines to help support our workforce needs. I'd like to provide a few specific examples of groundbreaking work that's been conducted recently at the University of Minnesota that will benefit Minnesotans and others on a national or even global scale. University researchers have created a first-of-its-kind ECMO vehicle, an emergency room on wheels that's the size of a fire truck. This can meet cardiac arrest patients in the field and indeed has helped save over 10 lives already in its first year of duty here in the state. We are developing a portable MRI machine, one that can be transported on the bed of a pickup truck that not only will help us in rural areas of our own state, but really can be used all throughout the world to enable broader access to this important diagnostic tool. Dr. Laura Niedenhofer and her colleagues on the Twin Cities campus are studying sentient, which are aging cells, and are developing therapeutics that may curb the prevalence of chronic diseases as we age. At our Rochester campus, innovative programs are prepping health science professionals in high-demand fields, and the University of Minnesota Rochester student body and equitable outcomes are contributing to better racial representation in healthcare. Through the University of Minnesota Duluth Natural Resources Research Institute, you researchers recently released the new Innova tree, a hybrid poplar tree that is meant to withstand the challenges of climate change. And as a terrific bonus, this tree also grows an astonishing 10 feet per year. And our Morris campus is a national leader in green initiatives, including wind energy with its two wind turbines, biomass energy, and the Pride of the Prairie Sustainable Food Project. And of course, our extension services are available in every county in the state. Talk about statewide impact. Two more examples, if you'll indulge me, just from the past week. The University of Minnesota just announced that we're going to be joining forces with several tribal nations in Minnesota in a new groundbreaking collaboration aimed at stopping the spread of chronic wasting disease in deer on and near tribal lands. And last week, the United States Department of Commerce selected the Minnesota MedTech 3.0 is one of its inaugural tech hubs to accelerate innovation and discovery. if I could take a couple of minutes to share my priorities for the upcoming year. When I first came into the office, I was named to the position in early May. My first official day was June 10th, but kind of had the opportunity to get a month's running start, if you will, and meet with leaders throughout the campus and really talk what is happening in this upcoming year and what do we need to get on, and ultimately developed a list of 22 different items that are very temporal in this current year. From this longer list, I sat down with the Board of Regents at our July meeting, and we refined a set of four priorities that they really wanted to be sure I spent personal time on. And one of them is an example of this today, which is the whole area of public outreach. On the legislative side, I'm really eager to have the opportunity and have had the opportunity to meet with several of you already, and we'll continue to do that as we head towards session. One of my first major hires as interim president was to get a new legislative leader, and we were very excited that Melissa Lopez-Franzen was available and was agreeable to joining our team and has been doing a great job thus far. This kind of outreach includes media outreach. I make myself available to tell the university's story and answer questions, and I've been doing that on television, radio, print, you name it, and really trying to get out to the community. I was at Farm Fest, I was at the State Fair, I've been in visits all around the state in that regard. A second priority area clearly is our health systems. A lot going on here in the Twin Cities that you're hearing about on a regular basis. We were excited to hear about the governor's task force on academic health at the University of Minnesota, and those meetings are ongoing right now, including three representatives directly from the university. We are also contemporaneously at this time having conversations with the Fairview organization about the potential future of that partnership. We're in year 27 of what's a 30-year agreement. There's a notice provision at the end of this year, however, for the parties to decide, okay, are we heading in a direction where we're going to stay together? Are we going to go a different direction, or is it going to be some blending of the two? And we'll keep everyone posted on how that's going. But I also wanted to point out that health systems are not just what's going on in the Twin Cities, and it's not just the Fairview partnership. We have a tremendous partnership between our University of Minnesota Rochester campus and the Mayo Clinic in terms of the curriculum that those health science students are engaged in on a daily basis. We were very excited and gratified to receive the support from the legislature last year for the new partnership in St. Cloud, a new medical school in partnership with CentraCare. It was really interesting to me to learn that in our state, we had not had new slots for medical students in this state since the 1970s. 50 years had gone by since the Mayo Clinic had started their medical school and we had started the Duluth program. And so well past time with our increase in population and with our increase in health needs to all folks. And so that will be excellent. And at the same time, we're looking at being able to expand our Duluth program. Right now, you spend your first 2 years of medical school on the Duluth campus, and then you either have to come to the Twin Cities campus or work elsewhere in the state. So we're looking to expand the Duluth opportunity to a four-year program, and that'll free up more slots in the Twin Cities as well. Third priority area would be in the area of public safety, and I've had a chance to talk with several of you about that topic as well. Again, we are very appreciative of the legislative support we received last session. You're going to hear from our chief here in the Twin Cities, Matt Clark, here later this afternoon. But I've really tried to take a personal involvement in meeting with parents and being engaged in safety walks and just really recognizing that our broader community in the Twin Cities campus, that's where our students live, that's where our parents and visitors come, and so we need to bear a collaborative responsibility for that area as well. And then the last area of priorities is the area of financial stewardship, and that's probably the most germane to this hearing here today. So it's no secret that higher ed has had its challenges in terms of enrollment on a national basis. Nationally, enrollment in four-year institutions is down 10% over the last 10 years, and we've seen obviously bigger drops than that in certain institutions here. Over that same 10-year time frame, the University of Minnesota has held steady. We had 68,000 students in the total system 10 years ago. We'll have 68,000 students in the total system this year as well. So we're bucking the national trend in that regard. But there has been a migration away from some of our greater Minnesota campuses. About 3,500 students total, if you will, have migrated away from some of those campuses, such as Morris and Crookston and Duluth, and have gone to the Twin Cities campus. And that's something I'm keenly aware of and keenly interested in trying to assist with. I'm from Greater Minnesota. When I moved here 35 years ago from the Southern California area. I've lived either in the Austin or Willmar areas the entire time, and I know how important the total University of Minnesota system is to the state. I'm working very closely with the system campuses to develop plans that are going to be strategically and financially viable at their current enrollment levels. We're certainly always going to continue to shoot to increase those enrollments. It would be great if we could get back to 10 or 20 years ago's enrollment levels. But as this committee is well aware, that's not what the national trends are showing. And so I think we have to have realistic game plans at each of those institutions to make sure that we're managing against this reality. And then lastly, I do want to recognize that affordability is definitely a key issue for all students. I hear about it directly from the students. I understand it as a parent who's gone through the system. We really appreciate the work of this group to enhance access through the North Star Promise last year. We've just enrolled our most diverse class ever here in the total University of Minnesota system, and we are very eager to find more ways to help future University of Minnesota students to enroll and succeed in our system, regardless of their financial status. So again, the message, national excellence, statewide impact, we need to be in a position where we're supporting both of those. With that, I'd like to turn the presentation at your indulgence over to our Vice President and Budget Director, Julie Tonneson, who will walk you through the current details of our University of Minnesota budget update.
President Ettinger, I know you have to leave at 2.
No, I'll be able to stay longer than that. I've switched my schedule, so thank you.
Then I think we'll proceed with the budget director. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record. And members, you have a rather detailed series of slides that she's going to be going through, so I would encourage you to take a look at those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Interim President Ettinger and Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Tonneson. I am the budget director for the University of Minnesota. Our plan today as part of this budget update is to walk you through a series of slides designed to help you understand a bit about our budget and our budget process, and to do that by bringing you up to date essentially on three things: tuition and enrollment, our FY24 budget allocations given the new appropriations we received for the biennium, and finally our board approved supplemental request for FY25.
Budget Director Tonneson, I'm going to stop you right there and just make an announcement. I have no authority, nor will I guarantee any type of a supplemental budget in 2024. So this is the focus of this is going to be on the appropriations that were passed into law in 2023, but there is absolutely no guarantee that there will be a supplemental budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to start this by focusing the conversation today. We will be actually talking primarily about the university's budget for the state O&M appropriation and tuition combined. Much like the state's general fund, you can think about it that way, these are the discretionary dollars we can use to support mission work directly, but also to pay for the overhead and the infrastructure necessary to allow the faculty to teach and to do research, and for many of our activities and functions to conduct outreach across the state. The university's total budget, all funds, includes about 34% that is restricted by source. That is the black and gray on this chart. Those funds are directed by the source to a stated purpose and cannot be used for anything else. The budget also includes our auxiliary businesses in the dark blue. That would be like the bookstore and parking and student dining. Enterprises that are managed to be self-sufficient operations through their rates. And it includes some other technically unrestricted funds at the campus or the Twin Cities College level that are generated by specific activities and are used to support those activities. Think about art course fees or the sale of time on a large microscope, for example. Those are in the red piece of this pie. All of those funds are part of our budget. They are monitored, projected, managed, but the budget process focuses a great deal on the 38% you see in maroon and gold here. Many leadership and board decisions focus on that 38% as we go through the budget process. Of the state appropriation and tuition combined, so the maroon and gold on this chart, 40% comes from the state appropriation and 60% is projected to come then from tuition. So we wanted to share some trends and up-to-date information about that particular important revenue source. First, the rates. Over the last 10 years, the university has worked hard to hold down the growth in tuition rates, especially for resident undergraduate students, which is what is on this particular chart. In FY15, the university received an increased appropriation from the state to hold these rates flat compared to FY14. And since that time, we have built budgets with 0% increases three times at Crookston, Duluth, and Rochester, two times at Morris, and once on the Twin Cities campus. Across these years, the recommended rate increase was always at or less than the projected inflation rates at the time the rates were set. The result, the average annual increase by campus across this time frame has been less than 1% for the system campuses and is 1.5% for the Twin Cities campus. Moving to enrollment over this particular time period, we have two slides. First is total enrollment by campus, all levels. This includes graduate, undergraduate, professional, plus all non-degree registrations, which is people taking a course but not admitted and enrolled into a degree program. These totals are the official counts based on where a student is enrolled, not necessarily where they receive all of their services. A case in point, we have students enrolled in the undergraduate nursing program in the School of Nursing, but are part of a partnership program and are physically taking their coursework in Rochester. They would be included in the Twin Cities numbers on this chart, even though they are physically located in Rochester and receive campus-based services there. There isn't a lot of this across the system, but it is worth noting. Moving up from the bottom, the 7.3% change for the Twin Cities campus over this time does need an explanation. College and the schools registrations and data changed starting in 2022-23. Many used to register later in the year, after the date we pulled our official data, but beginning in the fall of 2022, that timeline for registering moved up. So now they are incorporated into the official counts. So they're not actually increased enrollments, they are just newly recognized in our reporting. Without that change, total enrollment on the Twin Cities campus is relatively flat in 2023-24 compared to 2014-15. Rochester's trajectory is up and has been close to plans along the way until this year. The drop this fall is largely attributable to unplanned and unfortunate staffing issues that negatively impacted their recruitment plans, particularly in the Twin Cities metro area. The chancellor says they are now fully staffed and back on track, and in fact, the fall 2024 numbers are looking promising. In applications, admits, and campus visits, the key indicators are trending up over last fall. The changes you see for Crookston, Duluth, and Morris are consistent with what is happening more broadly across the country to small and medium-sized regional campuses, as Interim President Ettinger mentioned. We have been making adjustments and changes across this time frame on those campuses. Decisions have been made along the way to help adjust the budget for this changing situation. Looking at Morris just quickly as an example, that the one with the largest change over this time period, they have reduced positions, faculty and staff. They have restructured operations to decrease costs, sometimes through new partnerships within the community and or through different consolidations on campus. While many of their costs are somewhat fixed and tied to the basic infrastructure that really doesn't shift with changes in enrollment, they have still managed to reduce their FY23 spending level down by 27.2% from where it was in FY14 after adjusting for inflation. Arriving at the right size in today's demographic environment is a work in progress, something that the chancellors, particularly at Crookston, Duluth, and Morris, are wrestling with, as Interim President Ettinger mentioned in his comments, and we'll discuss that a little bit more in an upcoming slide. Reviewing the same table, but just for degree-seeking students now, you can see where the non-degree counts make a difference in some of the totals and the changes over time. The Twin Cities change over time now excludes that reporting shift for college and the school students and pulls out all the other non-degree registrations, and so the total has decreased about 2% over the last 10 years. The entering freshman classes are strong. In fact, in the last couple of years, we've had the largest entering classes in decades, but that is offset here by a reduction in graduate students and transfer students, and to some degree, a decrease in retention rates in the last couple of years. For the other campuses, the totals by year are less from removing the non-degree, but the trends remain the same as on the previous slide. Now, what do those most recent enrollment numbers mean for revenues? In most years, our projected tuition revenue for the budget turns out to be less than 1% off from what we actually receive at the end of the year. Last year, you will remember that halfway through the year during session, we communicated to you that our new estimates based on spring term registrations indicated our tuition revenues were coming in about $24 million below budget, which led to our adjusted biennial appropriation request. That large of a variance was very unusual and driven primarily by an unanticipated drop in retention rates across the system. Our estimating processes actually failed us, so this year we have instituted a change in those processes. We are now estimating current year revenues earlier based on fall registrations, and that is what you see reflected here for this fiscal year, a very early estimate. We are working with each system campus and each college on the Twin Cities campus to first verify these numbers with them, to understand the variances, and then to adjust their budgets now as necessary, adjust their spending primarily, so that we don't have to play catch up in the FY25 budget. The variance is actually within the normal range for the Twin Cities campus at a minus 0.4%, and that does not pose a problem for the budget. Crookston's budget for this year is in a good place as they look to be experiencing potential revenues above what they planned. Rochester is facing what is believed to be a one-time shortfall that I just mentioned that will be addressed through reserves. For Duluth and Morris, however, the variances are again in the wrong direction and continue to be troubling. We've already begun to work with them on verifying these estimates and developing actions to lower costs in real time. In all cases, we will update the estimates in February again and will adjust our plans as necessary. At the same time...
Budget Director Toss, I'm going to stop you for a second.
Sure.
I appreciate your comments about being able to at least predict enrollment and tuition. During the course of the legislative session, there was difficulty in you giving us numbers that were current, and I appreciate the fact that you're doing it now. Can you explain again what you changed from this year to last year, and is it a permanent change, or is it just for this committee?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the change is permanent, but what we changed is in prior years, we waited to do our current year revenue estimate until after the start of spring term. So we never did a fall estimate. We waited until spring. As I'm sure you realize, the enrollment and registration shift during the year, and so we waited later because it provided better information for the current year. But it also meant that we didn't catch some things that were happening soon enough in the year to take a lot of proactive action to address it in that current year. So now we have instituted a process where we are estimating in the fall. We've also tweaked our methodology a little bit, but we're estimating in the fall based on the registrations right away in September and seeing what you see here on the previous slide. This is for this fall. So now we have an opportunity to proactively work where we see a problem to address it this year rather than catch it later and not be able to make changes.
So Budget Director Tonneson, if we have another interim hearing in January, just prior to the start of the February 12th session, you would then be able to give us adjusted figures based on these figures at one of those hearings?
Mr. Chair, we would be able to adjust it for things we've learned from the campuses, but we won't do an official estimate until after the start of updated estimate until after the start of spring term, which starts, we wouldn't have the data until very early February.
Okay. I appreciate the new approach that the university is taking on how it's presenting its budget.
Sure. Thank you. So somebody let's get to this. So at the same time, while we're doing this revised estimating process, we are still moving forward on two fronts, really to strategically plan for operating with lower enrollments than in the past at Crookston, Duluth, and Morris. First, we are working to maintain and even increase enrollment from what it is today. Not realistically back to what it once was, perhaps, but to be in a stronger position than it is this fall. They have each been investing in recruiting resources, including updating marketing and communication strategies and a renewed focus on admissions practices. And they are implementing changes in programs to better meet student demands and needs. which has in some cases involved leveraging programming on the Twin Cities campus to better serve their students where it makes sense. And second, they are continuing to right-size their budgets to better fit the expected enrollments. This has been happening over time, as I mentioned, but there is a renewed focus now on making some tough decisions that will result in reduced costs. Across these two efforts, both in gaining enrollment and in controlling costs, let me mention a few examples. Crookston has recently completely restructured their Student Affairs and Student Success Center to more effectively meet the needs of students. And as a result, their fall 2023 first to second year retention rates are the highest they've seen. Duluth is working on strategies to optimize their financial aid offerings, and they have implemented an expansion of resident tuition rates to students from other states in the region beyond Wisconsin and the Dakotas, both to attract more students and again to positively impact retention rates. Duluth is also working on a very detailed academic program array analysis for both undergraduate and graduate programs, with changes on the number and the organization of academic programs to take effect by the fall of 2025. And Morris, in addition to the expenditure reductions I mentioned earlier, is elevating new three-year pathways to degree plans in all 34 of their majors, allowing students to utilize credits gained in high school or through summer courses to attract students and reduce their time to degree. These are all just examples, but things are moving, and we will continue to help them stay on track and make adjustments as necessary as we go forward. Shifting over now to the new state O&M appropriation
budget, I'm going to stop you again.
Sure.
I want to go back to that previous slide.
Sure.
I'm going to the second checkoff under continuing to adjust campus budgets. I know what faculty are. At least I think I know what faculty are. I've been adjunct faculty for 30 years. Define staff for me, will you?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, staff in our language, I guess, at the university is pretty much everybody other than faculty, other than those who teach and do research directly with the students and the
So
and the
budget
labs.
Director Thompson, that would include administration?
It does, Mr. Chair.
And yes, if we would ask for a breakdown of this starting in February, you would be able to give us a breakdown of faculty and staff by administration costs and others that would be on these lists?
Mr. Chair, yes, we could. Yes, we can.
I'm going to alert you in advance. I would like to see a breakdown of exactly, compared to faculty, what this staff elimination would also be.
Sure.
Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I always have a little concern about when we start talking about administrative cuts, right? The last thing that I want to see happen is a PhD professor or researcher standing at the copy machine making copies, right? That's not the most efficient use of state resources. In previous years, looking at the budget books that you have provided to us. Now, keep in mind, I've only been here since January of 2019. When I looked at some of those reductions, that was a bit concerning to me. So when we look at that, the cost-benefit ratio of those, whatever you call them, reductions, is something also that I'm very concerned about. So I want to make sure that we are being very wise with those cuts, and I just want to also bring cutting administration strictly to say we've cut administrative numbers, but then we've put the cost on a different part of the books is not something I want to see either. So thank you.
Representative Cleaborn, did you get the 2023 budget book?
The last budget book, we didn't, 2023, I can't remember which ones I had. Yes, I think you provided those for us.
Representative Cleaborn, I did not provide them. I was given one in September. The new government relations person apparently found a stack of them in J.D. Burton's closet. So I was given one in September in Winona. It's a beautiful historic document. And if I'm looking for here, if there are more to the stack, bring the whole stack and pass them out.
Yeah.
So I see that she's not. Are there more in that closet?
No closet, but you'll get them electronically.
All right. We'll get you the 2023, so we can update that.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I wanted to make sure that everyone gets the 2023. All right.
Chair, may I have one more other question? This is a question. So, in the systems campus plans and action, when it talks about creating connection to the Twin City-based courses and programs, would that be like hybrid learning where they would zoom into a class being offered at the Twin Cities campus, or what would that look like?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleaborn, it could. It could also mean, for example, taking advantage of the, what is it, 3+1 programs and so forth, where there's a direct connection and a line for the students to access Twin Cities programming. But it could also be course, actual course delivery as well.
Thank you.
So, for example, our Crookston campus that has an outstanding, oh, I'm sorry, sure. Mr. Chair and committee, our Crookston campus has a very outstanding agricultural program on the local campus, but also takes advantage of the opportunity to collaborate with CFANS on the St. Paul campus in the Twin Cities. Sorry.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Tonneson, in regards to this slide that the chairman had you bring up in the second section where you're reviewing programs, the demand size, what I hear from my district is just the programs that perhaps aren't demand, but the U of M has had for a number of years. It's always tough to cut programs, of course, and staff and professors, but the hard work has to be done. I would presume, but wanted to clarify it with you, that in bold headlines will be reviewing programs, demand, size, et cetera, and eliminating those that are not productive and that don't have the need or demand. And furthermore, is there such programs? I would presume there are, because I've heard there was over the many years I've been in the legislature. And is that the plan? And if so, will we be able to see that here? Would you present that to this legislature body?
Budget Director Tonneson.
I will start, Mr. Chair. Representative McDonald, yes, to your first question, it is about reviewing for demand and so forth with the intent of making sure that all of our programs, there is enough demand to continue them. So if there isn't, they would be on the recommended elimination list. The campuses are working on this right now. We do not have today decisions on that. They're going through a very internal robust process with lots of input from their academic community to do that program array analysis. So we are awaiting the results of that in the next couple months, I believe, is when they're going to start, probably by the first of the year, they're going to start coming up with recommendations.
President Ettinger.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and committee members. It's clear, I totally agree with the concept that ultimately, I mean, I came out of the business world and ultimately kind of your consumers ultimately decide which of your products survive and which of them thrive. And in this case, clearly, notwithstanding our great research work, our consumers, if you will, are our students. And so if we have programs on campuses that have now historically found that the students are just not gravitating toward those programs, it is incumbent upon us to make some changes in that regard. As I'm learning, again, new to this world, it is a shared governance system. The faculty plays an important role, so I certainly want to consult with faculty on any of those type of decisions. In addition to that, in both the Duluth and Crookston campuses, the faculty are represented by the UEA, and so that is a union-negotiated aspect in terms of what we offer. But we're definitely looking at all those things on the timetable that Ms. Tonneson described.
Representative McDonald?
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that information. Do you know, to your knowledge then, has there been programs that you have canceled or just completely repealed in the last 10 years or so? I'm sure this isn't a new topic, of course. So has that been the case?
Budget Director Tonneson.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, yes, there has been. In fact, it is on program changes are a regular agenda item for the Board of Regents meetings on a regular basis, additions and eliminations.
Representative Robbins.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had not raised my hand yet. I have some in a different direction. I think Representative Scott has questions.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here today to present. And I had a couple questions, one going back to what you said about the loss of staff at Rochester and how that translated into fewer students being enrolled. Mm-hmm. And since you were kind of on the topic about, you know, staff and that sort of thing, reducing faculty and staff, what happened at Rochester?
Budget Director.
And how many, Mr. Chair, and how many staff quit And was it just staff or was it faculty as well?
Budget Director Tonneson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I don't have right in front of me how many it was, but I will say it wasn't, and I don't want the committee to think that it was through budget cuts that that happened. It was just a turnover issue, so people left and we weren't unable, they were unable to hire replacements in time to impact the recruiting cycle. So there was a time period where they were down in staff, and I, again, I'm sorry, I don't know how many, but not a huge number, but it's a small place, and so even down one or two would make a difference in that key time of recruiting, which is what happened. So they were left without, I think for a period of months, staff that would have been recruiting, particularly in the Twin Cities metro area, and that's where they saw the drop in the freshman admissions was in from the Twin Cities metro area.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one other, just more of a statement, well, sort of a question too, but in looking at all the declining enrollment, the decline in certain programming and that sort of thing, I've noticed that the University of Wisconsin has been in the news lately, and they're going to be shutting some campuses down. And I'm just wondering how the University of Minnesota and the University of Wisconsin, if there's a comparison there as far as number of students and all those things. Is that something that is even on the table at some point and shutting down a potential campus if the enrollment is just not there and the consumer, as President Ettinger said, there's just no desire on the consumer's part for that product?
Budget Director Tonneson, do you want that one or does President Ettinger want it?
Mr. Chair, I'll just clarify one thing and then I will turn it over.
Right.
And the one thing is that the Wisconsin system is the combination of the university and the Minnesota State system here in Minnesota. So it isn't exactly apples to apples with the university. It is that broader set of campuses that is in the Wisconsin system, including the two-year institutions.
Okay.
And with that, I will.
President Ettinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. You know, as somebody who lives in southern Minnesota, and we all remember we used to have a Waseca campus for the University of Minnesota, and so indeed there had been action in that regard taken. As we look at the campuses today, we certainly always kind of keep that in mind, but we don't think that's the current exigency we're in. Looking at Crookston, for example, which is probably the most remote campus of all of our campuses, they've done a very nice job at having both a complimentary virtual program that they draw students honestly from across the country for, in addition to their residential program. And so we're going to keep working with each of the campus chancellors to develop both a strategy and a financially sustainable model. So at this point, we think we can still do that.
Thank you.
Representative Scott. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. President, and also Budget Director. The key question that I, you know, like to ask is about the marketing, because when you market something, you're selling a product, or you're trying to create a program that people will move to attend and enroll at the U. So one of the issues that I've been talking about for many years is we have the PSEO program. More than 1,500 individuals apply. We only take 45% of that. And at the GPA level that we're trying to meet is almost 3.94 unweighted average. How do we make sure that we really attract those students who want to come to the U by ensuring that we can expand those programs so that we allow more students to be enrolled before they're even attending the U?
Budget Director Tonneson or President Ettinger, I'm not sure which one.
I'll go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. Clearly this year, for example, there's what's kind of reputational marketing, if you will, and then there's enrollment marketing. Our university had not engaged in reputational marketing in 4 years. Hopefully you've seen the Dear Minnesota campaign that we have out there that does talk about many of our accomplishments and featured students and faculty from all five of our campuses. That's important work to keep our work front of mind with parents and with students. That will be supplemented or complemented, if you will, with marketing related to admissions. In that regard, we have all the campuses working closely together and finding ways to make sure we collaborate on that. We're also looking at opportunities that we can potentially, if a student is applying to one school, can we make sure that the other options are available as well? You asked a specific question, though, and I think we owe you maybe a follow-up answer on that particular category of students and how we're going after those.
Okay. Representative Noor.
Just a follow-up on that, the PSEO program, mostly it's done in class, and there's an opportunity to do online, so students across the state can attend those programs. Mm-hmm. And so how do we ensure that we create that opportunity for many students who don't have that access today? So we'll follow up if we, on that issue.
Budget Director Tonneson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Noor, the only thing I will add, we're happy to follow up, but as I understand it, and I haven't delved into this in many years, but the post-secondary enrollment options program is run through the state and through the Department of Education at the state, and so we are happy to work with them about how can we generate interest in that. I believe the funding also is directed by the state in terms of paying the tuition for that. And so we're happy to talk with anybody about ideas on how we can improve that.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Budget Director, I think the question is, we are rejecting many students who apply at the U. So how do we make sure that we enroll those students, even to the fact that there are some students who appeal that, saying that they go to other places for PSEO. But the University of Minnesota has told them no. Even if when they appealed, they're told, no, we don't want you to come to the U. So how do we make a change? And also, we're looking for the best of the best, students who are performing, outperforming everyone else, 3.94. That's the weighted average, unweighted average that we're taking PSEO through the University of Minnesota. The funding is coming from the state. Yeah. Why don't we open up to make sure that more students are enrolled through that program, whether it's online and other mechanisms? So I think there's a problem. There's a system problem that we need to fix.
Budget Director Tonneson, I think you've heard him.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Okay. We will look into that.
All right.
Okay.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, and I just wanted to team tag on that comment about PSEO and the fact that we have so many more students applying to the Twin Cities campus than we can possibly accept. But we have vacancies on the Morris campus. To try to retain those students, is there any way we can accept them with a promise if a GPA maintains at a certain level, they would be able to transfer in? I just don't want us to lose the brain trust of Minnesota to other states. That's all. Thanks.
Just Director Tonneson or? Nope, no response. All right. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for being here today. I am still new to this committee, so I apologize if this question is something everybody else here knows, and I do not. But I was approached by students this year, master's students, MSW students, who informed me that after starting classes this year, their tuition was increased substantially, and that there was bridge funding offered for some students and not for others. I was also informed that there was quite a concern about the retention of some of those students, and that we lost some students because they were not able to close that gap in the financial aid that they thought they had. So as a student myself, when I was in college, I had all of my financial aid figured out before I started classes. That includes housing costs and all of that. And so for these students to face that was really concerning for me, especially considering that we are in somewhat of a crisis for social workers in Minnesota. We know that mental health crises are touching every single family from border to border right now. And so to hear that there were students who are future therapists in Minnesota that were facing this really concerned me. There could be a very viable explanation, but when I was looking at the correspondence that these students received, unfortunately, it did not reflect some of the values that we've talked about here today. And so don't need to answer it now, but I would like to hear about how we're supporting students and if it is a common practice for us to be increasing students' tuition after they've already finalized their financial aid and how we can make sure we can better support some students. We cannot afford to lose any more prospective therapists in Minnesota, and so a follow-up is fine. I don't need an answer today, but did want to get that on the record. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions from any members? Representative McDonald, was that a you need to ask a question or no?
Mr. Chair, is it the end of the session?
We've got a lot of work.
I see the agenda here.
We've got, okay. So proceed.
Okay. All right. Shifting over now to the state O&M appropriation portion of our revenues, we thought it might be helpful to provide information on how the additional funding appropriated for FY24 has been incorporated into the budget for this year. and a bit about how we make decisions in the budget process on where those dollars go. And we'll start first with a recap on the increased appropriations the university received for specific purposes as directed in the appropriation law. And for that, we'll start with an explanation of the impact the new safety and security dollars are having. And I will ask our chief of police, Matt Clark, to join us here at the table to walk through the next two slides, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Chief Clark, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having me. I'm Matt Clark. I'm the chief of police at the University of Minnesota and also with the Department of Public Safety. On the first slide, we are talking about a recurring $1 million appropriated to the Department of Public Safety by the legislature this year. That money was spent on two different sections. The first section would be approximately $500,000 to pay for our security data and access program coordinator, that is system-wide, and also to cover $400,000 with the current budget so that we are essentially made whole with replacing security systems across all of our campuses in the state. The second allotment of money went to what we were asking for, which is additional personnel. That would include two officers in the Twin Cities campus, one police officer in Duluth, half officer in Morris campus, security officer, and then an additional K-9 bomb detection unit for the Twin Cities campus. Additionally, we were given an $8 million non-recurring allotment that went specifically to a system-wide program to make sure that all of our camera systems were up to date. Those camera numbers are listed on the slide. 16 in Duluth, 992 in the Twin Cities campus, 139 in Crookston, 19 in Morris, and then none in Rochester because we had updated those the year prior. Additionally, we added a $2 million access card reader system for Duluth campus. We also used the non-reoccurring funds to provide for additional blue light kiosks on almost all of our campuses. That includes a camera system and emergency 911 connection. We updated our software so that we can integrate all first responders as much as possible on our campuses. And then we also added to our 911 and radio infrastructure system for responders on each of the campuses.
Questions, members? Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for getting my new name correctly. I appreciate that.
I think to get the name Kent, you have to apply for that yourself. We've already made an inquiry, and that's got to come from you. So
I have them up on my desk. I just need to bring them down. I will bring it for the next one. Thank you, Chief Clark, for being here. I just have a couple quick questions just to clarify some of the things that you had just said. So the legislature did give you money for additional officers. Have they been hired?
Chief Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, they have not been hired yet.
Okay.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Chair. And then also, you listed off on nearly 1,000 cameras on the Twin Cities campus. Is that in total, or are those additional cameras? And if we have 1,000 or so cameras, or maybe more, on the Twin Cities campus, is there any blind spots? It seems like that's an awful lot of cameras, even as big as that campus is.
Chief Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have 5,500 cameras that we monitor in our 911 communication center. That is for all campuses. I don't have the exact number on the Twin Cities cameras. As you can imagine, when those get to an end-of-life period, we need to replace those so that the images stay clear. The 900 on the Twin Cities campus that we are replacing are the current ones that are past end of life. And I believe we're in about 3,000 plus cameras on just the Twin Cities campus alone. There are blind spots when you have 2,700 acres and 250 buildings just in the Twin Cities campus alone. And we're near 500 different buildings across the entire system. So we are trying to cover as much as possible. Our goal is to make sure that not only are we recording what's going on each one of our campuses, much like a K through 12 campus, but at the same time, we're able to contact first responders who are up responding to emergencies to let them know what's going on campus.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you. That's so if you have 5,500 cameras across all your campuses, that's a lot of cameras to be watching. I'm not sure. Just for example, at the Twin Cities campus, how many staff do you have monitoring all of those screens, or how do you prioritize that? That's an awful lot of screens to be watching at any given time. And then I'll follow it up with one other additional question. I was honored to be able to go on a safety walk, and I see we have Regent Farnsworth here. He was among with us when we went. I was there with even Senator Dietzick and now Senator Rarick and a few others. And as we walked along, Senator Rarick and I stopped and talked to one of your officers, and he told us quite the story. He had stopped a stabbing, chased the criminal down, was cut up himself, but saved one of your students from being stabbed. Then processed him and sent him off to Hennepin County, and the county attorney declined to press charges, and he was incredibly frustrated. And he said, "Why do I put my life on the line when now Mary Moriarty won't press any charges?" Has there been any conversations between yourself or the University of Minnesota or the president and Hennepin County Attorney's Office that they would actually prosecute and protect your students?
Chief Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative. I have had conversations with the county attorney. As you know, our Twin Cities campus is both in Ramsey County and Hennepin County. Also talked to County Attorney John Choi in the Ramsey side. We do have a lot of conversations. My goal is to have the best police response and safety response possible on campus, and then to have the best investigation and provide for the best case that we submit to those county attorneys. When possible, I will talk directly with a county attorney or a prosecuting attorney to work with them on what they need for a case. Is there frustration with the entire criminal justice system? Yes. That is something that's going on across the Twin Cities. Are we going to do our best with what we have to make sure that criminals are held accountable? Absolutely. And I'll continue to do that.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chief Clark, for that. I'm sure it has to be incredibly frustrating. You're tasked with trying to protect, you know, 68,000 or so students coming and going, faculty, staff, everybody. And I know that I've even heard from faculty and staff, and they're just literally terrified walking to their cars and ramps and such because of the rampant crime. So the last thing I have is, do you know how long it will be before you're able to hire? It looks like you've got 3.5 total FTEs of officers and then a couple others, but do you know how long it'll be before you're able to actually hire those?
Chief Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're right now at 55 sworn officers for the Twin Cities campus. Both Morris and Duluth have their own chiefs. They are almost a full staff. We are slotted for 73 officers with this additional allotment of officers. I'm hopeful that we'll be in the 60s by the end of the year or into 2024. The recruitment is very difficult in the Twin Cities. Mm-hmm. We're seeing it across all of the Twin Cities city police departments as well. I've talked to the chief of Minneapolis and St. Paul as well. They have their challenges. It's a difficult time to recruit officers and to get them to come to the campus. I consider campus policing a specialty policing. There's a lot about working with students that you need the right mentality when you bring those folks in. So we're going to do our best. We are very appreciative of President Ettinger, Senior Vice President Franz, who have prioritized hiring officers and security as a main part of making sure that we are fully staffed, and we're going to continue to work at it.
Just a final comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate that, and you and I have had conversations in the past, and I really do appreciate those. And, you know, having served for about 10 years on the Public Safety Committee and now on the HIRA Committee, it's kind of a cross-section of really important things, and I hear all sorts of things from across Minnesota, so I appreciate all the effort that you put in. I really hope that there is a massive change in our criminal justice system, and it's interesting to me that the federal government had to step in and actually prosecute some of the worst crime, and so I've actually had conversations with the attorney Luger, and he I shared my appreciation because I think of the work of the U.S. attorney and their prosecutions of violent crime in the metro. We've actually seen somewhat of a reduction, sometimes just a shift to different types of crimes, like the catalytic converter theft is just shifted to something else now. But in any case, I just wanted to share my appreciation, and I share your frustration. You know that. We've talked about that in the past. And I would hope that as a system, that your voice would be heard loud and clear by the Hennepin County attorney and Attorney John Choi, that in order to have a safe campus, in order to hire good officers to protect the campus, there needs to be a justice system that works. So I appreciate that, and I really hope that your voices become very loud about that. Thank you.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chief Clark, for your hard work on behalf of all of the campuses and students. I'm not honestly sure if my question is directed to you or to the budget director, so you guys can decide. But I was looking for an update on the data breach and also how much that's costing to hire the outside vendor credit reporting monitor Kroll. And I'm assuming that was an unanticipated cost. So how are you figuring that into the budget? Go ahead.
Budget Director Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, first, we have some insurance for such a thing, and then I'm waiting actually for the final bills. But we also have what, and we've spoken to the committee before about this, we have what's called a central reserve for unanticipated urgent needs, and that is where we will look first, and that will go through the Board of Regents if there are costs over and above insurance. I do not know what that is right now.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you feel like most of the public who is impacted has signed up for credit monitoring? Are we through that phase of the process, or where do we stand on that? Do you know?
Budget Director Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not. I am not tracking that. We'd have to ask someone else for that, but we can follow up.
Okay. Thank you. I have a follow-up, Mr. Okay. Chair. Not on this, on a new point.
All right. Representative Robbins.
Thank you. This may be for the chief again. So I was contacted by a constituent who has some concern about, and I'm not sure it's actually on university property, but a homeless encampment near the daycare on the university. And they're very concerned about this. And so I'm just looking for information. Is that something you're aware of? Is that something that's on university property? Or if not, do you work with the Minneapolis PD on this?
Chief Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know about an encampment on any university property. We've had some that were fairly close, and we have worked with other agencies. The jurisdictions are always somewhat a mystery. Sometimes it's a state, sometimes it's a county, and sometimes it's a city. But we do work with them to make sure that those are taken care of, but there's none on university property that I know of, but I definitely can take that information down later.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is on the subject of data, and I know lots of cameras on campus, right? And it's always interesting, the University of Minnesota and how they handle state Chapter 13 law and law enforcement law, but how long do you keep this data from all the cameras? Mr. Chair, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe it's 14 to 21 days. It depends on the level of storage that we have. We can mark them if there's something they're related to a case or an incident, but otherwise it's a short amount of time.
Okay, thank you.
No further questions? Representative Norris, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chief Clark. I think the collaboration with the community and the surrounding neighborhood really helped address some of the security issues during the summer. So I just wanted to inquire about, you know, jurisdiction issues. There are places whereby it's not under the University of Minnesota, but the city of Minneapolis. Or somehow we're trying to make sure that we do continue to work with the, you know, neighborhood organizations and folks who have been planning. Just a quick example, the pedestrian bridge on 14th Avenue had almost seven of the 10 lights not working, and I'm glad that the city just replaced it, you know, last week. And so it takes a lot of effort. So how do we make sure that we continue that collaboration with the communities surrounding the University of Minnesota to ensure that we don't have the recurrence of the incidents that we have seen during the summer?
Chief Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative, definitely having off-campus strategy for safety is important. The university has invested a lot in working with the city and the county and others to make sure that not only the lighting's up to the right levels, but also that we have different infrastructure in place. We have 8 light cameras that are stationed around Dickey Town, along with mobile cameras that we've put out in locations where students have said they've had incidents or where we have concerns. We're happy to share those with the city and provide additional officers. Our officers have been working off campus every night in Dinky Town and surrounding neighborhoods for more than a couple of years. And that is to make sure that if there's an emergency with one of our students or a faculty member or the community, we're there if Minneapolis or other agencies aren't able to get there. But I agree, there's also a piece behind working with the community. We have our community engagement team. Both the president and Senior Vice President Franz have been very good about encouraging community engagement as part of our safety plan on and off campus, and we'll continue to do that.
Representative Knorr.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair. The need for transportation, you know, like the chauffeur program that is provided, how can we expand to make sure that many students who want to utilize that type of a program, that they can be picked up and dropped and they can pay for some of that service at a very low rate? Is there any plan to establish a quick transportation system within the U area?
Chief Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr. I don't know much about that program, the Go for Chauffeur program, that's outside the Department of Public Safety. I do know we've worked with them in the past on and off campus. We do, as part of the Department of Public Safety, we have security escorts. We do anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 of those on and off campus a year. And we provide additional resources with our safety ambassadors in Dinky Town. They also do safety walks and escorts if somebody requests that.
Representative Knorr.
I think maybe that's a question for the administration in terms of the Go for Chauffeur to be able to provide that quick, you know, services to the students who maybe, you know, instead of working in the middle of the night, they can quickly request, you know, transportation system that is more reliable and that is within the system.
Okay. President Ettinger, did you wish to respond?
Just quickly, Chair Pawlowski and committee. Go for Chauffeur is actually a program that was a student-initiated program. It was their idea in student government nearly 10 years ago, and it has expanded significantly during that time frame. My understanding is it's a free program to students who utilize it, and we certainly can provide the committee next time information about how often it's used and whether we're in a position to expand it further.
All right, thank you. Designated new appropriations, I think, is next.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So continuing with the remaining designated appropriations, the university also received recurring and non-recurring increases for the items that you see listed here. We received additional funding, both recurring and non-recurring, recurring only for related to changes in the unemployment insurance laws. Our recurring base also increased, and we received non-recurring dollars to be allocated across all 5 campuses to ensure access to menstrual products. We're working now on the breakdown of the projected cost by campus, and we'll distribute the funds accordingly. Additionally, you provided $2 million in each of the next 2 years on a non-recurring basis to enhance the great work at the Natural Resources Research Institute, and $10 million one time to launch the medical school programming at the CentraCare Health System campus in St. Cloud. Funds that can be used for a residency program and various forms of student financial aid. The medical school is finalizing all aspects of the budget plan associated with that expansion. And next, while not a direct appropriation to the university, the state also enacted a new student financial support program, the North Star Promise Program, that will have a very positive impact on a large number of resident undergraduate students at the U beginning next academic year. So we wanted to share some early estimates on the impact of that program. First, based on student numbers and characteristics from 2022-23, we anticipate that the state contribution to our students eligible for the program could be close to $14 million. That will be spread differently across two income groups. For those from families with incomes below $50,000, the bar on the left, the majority of their tuition and fees total, or 74%, will be covered by the traditional combined sources of Pell, the Minnesota State Grant Program, and a variety of private and university scholarships. And the remaining 26% will be covered first by the university's existing Promise Plus program. That's the 21% that guarantees tuition coverage for students from families with incomes up to $50,000. And then with the final 5% covered by the new state program. Because the state program now extends the tuition and fees guarantees to students from families with incomes up to $80,000, the impact of the North Star program is greater for this group on the right at the University of Minnesota, with 65% of the guarantee expected to come from the traditional Pell, MSG, and other scholarships, 15% from the university's Promise program, which provides aid on a sliding scale to students from families with incomes up to $120,000, and then 21% from the new North Star program. By campus, the expected numbers of students benefiting from the program and the expected costs are on this slide. Overall, again, based on data from our last completed year, we anticipate roughly 8,700 students could be eligible to receive aid through this program. And the dollars to cover the tuition and fees guarantee are estimated at an investment of about $89 million from Pell, MSG, and scholarships, an additional $23 million from the university-funded Promise program for this population, and roughly $14 million from the new state North Star Promise program. In future years, the actual cost will depend on a number of factors, including enrollments of students eligible for the program and changes to tuition and fees or federal, state, and private financial aid programs. We're hopeful that this program will have a positive impact on enrollments, so we're eagerly anticipating the results. Moving now to the large $50 million recurring increase in our state appropriation and how that has been incorporated into our budget. I need to step back just a bit to briefly explain how we think about the budget for our O&M appropriation and tuition. We do incremental budgeting, much like the state does, where there is a base, a balanced budget from the prior year, with planned increases and decreases from that base as we move forward. At the institutional level, we then plan for incremental changes from that base in resources and in costs. The state appropriation is one of the resource changes we need to plan for, and that change, combined with our estimated change in tuition revenue and sometimes from other revenues that we can bring to the table, must cover the anticipated general fund cost increases related to student services, compensation, facility costs, inflation, and other issues, net of any planned spending cuts and reductions. So from a planning perspective, in the summer of 2022, when we first built our biennial request to the state, we were looking at the cost estimates that you see here, averaging about $90 million incremental each year on top of our balanced budget from the prior years. We have various ways of creating these estimates, but in each case, we were close to an anticipated $90 million challenge to solve for salary and fringe benefit increases, known and estimated facility costs, technology licensing increases, general inflation, and the miscellaneous mix of issues that our campuses and colleges and support departments face every year. Things like increased security personnel, new admissions counselors, new research-related equipment, expanded career service programming, additional faculty to serve a growing demand in a particular discipline, and so on. Our plan in the summer of 2022 was to ask the state to help us fund one half of that projected cost. And if you did, we would cover the other half through moderate and minimal tuition increases differing by campus and internal spending cuts. The board approved this general plan when we submitted our request to you in the fall of 2022, a year ago. Since that time, the board approved the budget for FY24, the first year of the biennium, last June, with the cost side going up $117.9 million and our early modeling is leading to cost increase estimates of roughly $100 million for FY25, so more than the $90 million in each of the 2 years of the biennium. From that original plan, then, how did the increased $50 million in O&M appropriation for FY24 fit into the approved budget? This is the high-level math representing the decisions made to balance this year's general fund budget for the university in total. Setting aside, the designated appropriations and transfers from the state and some central reserves as they are directed to particular things, the $50 million increase was combined with $39.5 million of planned internal budget cuts and other small revenue gains in the colleges and campuses, and an estimated $23.5 million incremental growth in tuition from enrollment changes and the 3.5% rate increase on the Rochester and Twin Cities campuses and 1% rate increases at Crookston, Duluth, and Morris. And the combination of those incremental resource gains were used to pay for the combination of costs identified here. Our 4% general salary increase and the accompanying benefit cost increases, the actual $23.3 million of tuition revenue shortfall from FY23, as we discussed earlier, a slightly lower than planned but still significant increase in facility and technology licensing costs, and then two categories of ever-changing issues and investments, the list of which can be found in our approved budget but includes such things as the public safety and security investments beyond those supported by the new designated state dollars, library collections, costs associated with academic program growth in some areas, like a new undergraduate program in the School of Public Health, for example, the budget deficits from tuition shortfalls, new compliance-focused positions, and so on. Plus, because we are facing a current law situation in which we get no appropriation increase for FY25, we also plan to hold almost $9 million as uncommitted on the bottom line that will be available to help address that $100 million anticipated cost growth for next year. We cut deeper and are leveraging growth in other revenues more than we planned to help create that balance. So what I just shared with you is at a high 30,000 foot level of the budget, but we do not create the budget only at that 30,000 feet. We plan at that level, but then we go through a thoughtful, long, and robust budget process to understand and address the varied issues faced by all of our campuses, colleges, and departments. We strategically build our budget across our four system campuses, the colleges, and other academic-focused activities on the Twin Cities campus, and then the many support organizations. We have 50 different what we call resource responsibility centers, which are budgeting units. Each system campus is a separate budgeting unit listed on the top here, and each of the 19 Twin Cities College and academic organizations, like Minnesota Extension, for example, listed below the line are separate budgeting units. Each primarily exist to do mission work. On this next slide.
Director Thomas, I'm going to just interrupt you for a second. Representative Rare had a question, and it may go back a slide or two. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really quickly, since so much of the shortfall, I guess we'll call it, is in compensation, which of course makes sense because typically around 80% or something of any organization is typically salaries. And you had mentioned very quickly that it's a 4% salary increase. So I'm wondering if you could just expound on that just a little bit. Is that every single employee will get a 4%, or do you do across the board increases? And if so, what are they, and do you do step increases? So I served on the subcommittee on employee relations, and we're looking at all the state employees across the board, and it's $11-12 billion that we look at. So I'm just wondering if you could give us just a little bit more meat on that, since it's such a big portion of this ask.
Budget Director Tonneson.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative, it is, from budgeting perspective, the 4% is like an average, if you think about it that way. How we actually implemented it is 4% was the settled agreements with our labor-represented employees. And for everyone else, it is a merit-based system, so they plan a pool last year, for the current year, of 3.85 3.75%, 3.75%, sorry, 3.75% as a general pool for merit-based increases. Some will get less, some will get more. And then we ask the units to set aside the final 0.25% to make market and equity adjustments across their population.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you could just let us know if you happen to know, like, how many members are in total of the union, so that's a little more challenging, less flexibility. I had Minn State's behind us, and they get to control some of the budgeting, and some of it is outside of their hands. It's negotiated by MMB, and so I'm just wondering if you could let me know how many people are in the unions in total.
Budget Director Townsend.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'll have to follow up with that. I don't have that detailed information here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Sorry. No, I did not advance, right? So I'm on. Okay. So let me go back to, on this next slide, you see that there are two Twin Cities-based auxiliary activities that are run more like businesses below the line, and then the list of 25 organizations, many of which hold system-wide responsibilities that exist to support the mission work. It is at this level, across these two slides, that we build the budget. We hold the leaders of these organizations accountable and responsible for the financial activity that occurs within them. We meet with them annually and in between if necessary to understand their budgetary issues, concerns, and opportunities, and we make decisions about how much state O&M each should get or how much they should cut their spending on their existing base, what their tuition rate changes should be, etc. Notice there is no Twin Cities campus listed here under the budget structure. We do not prepare a Twin Cities campus budget. We prepare budgets for all the organizations on this page and the next, the majority of which, whether they have system responsibilities or not, are located in the Twin Cities. This process is necessary due to the very different and unique characteristics of these units, and we believe it results in a very strategic resource and cost allocation process. The next five slides provide a deeper dive into recent results of that more strategic process. Each shows the set of resource and cost changes that impacted the budget for this year at that campus and college level. We've prepared a slide for Crookston, Duluth, Morris, Rochester, and then a Twin Cities College as examples of how the incremental budgeting decisions look in the end for these parts of our organization. And it is the sum of these results for each of the 50 resource responsibility centers that culminates in the total university budget that I walked through a few minutes ago. So let me walk you through one of the slides, but because they're all essentially work the same way, perhaps we can leave the detailed explanation of the other four examples for your review, and we would be happy to follow up with answers to any questions you have on them. But I can walk you through the first one so you see how it works. For Crookston, and for ease of explanation, I'm going to go a bit out of typical reading order and start at the bottom. Of the list of cost increases that are on the bottom of this table. Based on the general 4% salary increase pool that we just talked about and changes in benefit costs, the cost of compensation for the campus in the general fund was going up $887,000. Additionally, in the next lines, their portion of general overhead costs was increasing, $718,822 for core system services, provided by many of the departments on that list of support service centers on the previous slide. That would be for things like technology infrastructure, HR support, space planning, or security monitoring and response services, et cetera. And then utilities were estimated to grow $27,500. We knew we had to address a negative structural imbalance carried forward from the prior year, a case in which non-recurring revenues of $1.2 million were used to cover recurring costs in that year. And on the very next line, that was coupled with the further shortfall in tuition during FY23 compared to budget, again, that we talked about earlier, recurring costs not covered by recurring resources in that prior year. And finally, we approved a plan to cut their spending by $527,413. As a result, the net change in projected cost increases after the additions and the cuts was just over $2.6 million. I hope you can see that on there. So how did we pay for all those things? Moving to the top of the list, first, based on the board-approved 1% increase in the tuition rate for Crookston and their planned enrollment levels, we anticipated a growth in their tuition revenue for this year of $368,000. On the next line, we agreed to make a transfer from central reserves to them of $286,000 and to provide additional O&M transfers of over $600,000 to hold them budget neutral related to some of those centrally driven cost allocations I mentioned. And then in the gold box, we approved an increase in their recurring O&M allocation of just over $1.3 million for the balance of the cost increases. And that is from the $50 million in new appropriations provided by the state. For this unit and every other one, along the way to these decisions, we ask the questions you see on the right, in addition to others that are more specific to that particular circumstance. We need to know what is happening with their enrollment and associated tuition revenue. We need to know what unresolved issues they have from prior years. We need to know what impact their proposed spending cuts will have and what cost increases they are facing. And finally, we need to know how much state money we will have to address these challenges. The answers are different for each of the 50 budgeting units. As I said, I will spare you the same explanation for each of the four next slides. But we are happy to answer questions related to the other regional campuses and the one collegiate example on the Twin Cities campus, and that's for the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if Ms. Tonneson could get the committee, because I'm assuming you probably don't have the breakdown here, but the reasons why there's such an increase in the utility costs at some of these campuses, if you could get a breakdown for that for us, that'd be really
sure. Sure. She's nodding, she will.
Thank you.
Budget Director Tonneson, I want to focus on the red number at the bottom.
Okay.
I heard you say that the campus makes that decision and not central office in Minneapolis. They make those decisions?
Mr. Chair, they will ultimately decide what to reduce, which items to reduce in their budget. Yes, we give them a target. They often respond with, here's our early plans related to that and the projected impact of that. And then we finalize the number. And then we return to them the following year to ask, again, what their plans are and what they actually implemented.
That's not exactly the answer to my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My question was, they decide the number or do you decide the number?
Mr. Chair, we decide the number.
Okay, that's a little bit misleading from the presentation then, that it was a campus-based decision. You're going to decide the number, and then they decide how they're going to handle the cut.
Correct.
Okay. I just wanted clarity on it.
Yeah.
Because that's what I've been told campus by campus.
Yep, that is the truth, sir. Yep. Okay, those are the four campuses, and again, if there's follow-up questions on those, we can get to that. And now, with your permission, we will move to the final section of the presentation. I do hope, though, as you can see, if you look through those five slides and the gold box of where the $50 million went, I hope you can see that incremental new $50 million of core basic support that you provided for FY24 was critically important in balancing our budget in a responsible way for all of our campuses and colleges. It allowed us to keep tuition rate increases at the level we originally planned, and combined with that revenue and internal spending cuts, it did allow us to address our unavoidable cost increases and priority investments to remain compliant, to ensure safety, to meet student demands, and so forth. For FY25, we are facing a very similar set of issues and challenges, so I'll turn it now over the conversation over to Interim President Ettinger to introduce our supplemental budget request.
President Ettinger.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee. We engaged in a consultative process this summer to allow us to get input from the University Committee on priorities for both the capital budget request, which is not the subject of this committee, but also for a potential supplemental operating budget request, mindful of the fact that it's dependent on the overall state
finances. President Ettinger, I'm going to just remind you that this committee will have a hearing on the capital requests of both systems. That hearing may be in January, but it will most certainly be in February because of the importance of a possible bonding bill. And I know your HEPA request is significant. So we will review the capital requests of both systems in this committee.
Very well, sir. Thank you. the themes that emerged from our students, faculty, and staff member with whom we spoke this summer really were the notions that we need to focus on the needs of students and any kind of financial aspects that we're looking at in a budget request, that we need to acknowledge and support the needs of our faculty and staff around issues of compensation, and that we're seeking to remain a national leader and an economic driver for the state of Minnesota in many areas, including healthcare, wellness, workforce, and sustainability. We, in working with our Board of Regents, are proposing to advance the same requests we submitted last year, which would be for a $45 million incremental increase in our recurring O&M appropriation beginning July 1, 2024. This would be a 3.3% increase in our biennial base appropriation. Instead of our current biennial base of $1.34 billion, it would result in a biennial base of $1.39 billion. We're hoping that this request is simple and direct and is consistent with what the legislature heard from the university last year. Mr. Chair, if it would be okay with you, I'd like to turn it over again to Vice President Tonneson to walk us through some specifics of our supplemental request proposal.
Sure. Budget Director Tonneson.
Thank you. The incremental $45 million in our original biennial request and now in the supplemental proposal is about students first and foremost. By supporting the core, we make it possible to continue to provide the world-class instruction that students deserve and to provide the academic support services necessary for them to succeed. It will also make it possible to provide the wraparound services to address their safety and security needs, their campus life experiences, and it will even make it possible to provide the research and public engagement activities that result in unique opportunities for students to gain experience. It's also about moving forward to strengthen and advance our role as the Academic Health Center for the state in new discoveries and educational and service innovation. The core is all about making these things possible, because what the additional funds would pay for in combination with some tuition revenue gains and continued internal cuts are those nuts and bolts things listed on the bottom of this slide. Without the technology and the facilities and the physical equipment and supplies, the learning and the research could not happen. And most importantly, without the people, none of what we do is possible. We simply must fairly compensate our employees and work to address the many needs of our workforce. The impact of the $45 million would be meaningful. The core services I just summarized must be supported at some level. We can't simply just turn them all off or down. So if the state provides this support, it will allow us to do major impactful things. I'll highlight just a few before turning the conversation over to some who are closer to the potential benefits than I am. But first, it will allow us to implement lower tuition rate increases for students than we otherwise would be considering, therefore directly impacting the cost of attendance and working to hold down the dependence on student loans. Second, it will also allow us to better maintain services for students. And maintenance doesn't mean standing still. It means continually evaluating and improving and modifying the programs and services we offer to best fit their ever-changing needs. We are listening, and we need to fuel that continuous improvement process. Third, it will allow us to meet more of the demands we have related to our spaces and our physical environment. Our efforts to reduce our physical footprint do continue, but we will always have classrooms, libraries, labs, offices, and gathering spaces, and those must be safe, functional, sustainable, and accessible, while also being very conducive to excellence in teaching, learning, and research. And finally, it will help our efforts to fairly support our faculty and staff. Supporting our core operating costs, our core mission activities, is really supporting the heart of the university, I like to say. And with that, Mr. Chair, I can turn it over to our student and our faculty representative here with us today for a few
comments.
All right.
Who wishes to come down first?
Can I ask a question?
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Brett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had said you were going to be limiting the tuition increases. Limiting to what? What is the goal?
President.
Chair. So for the past 2 years, the increase for the Twin Cities campus has been 3.5%. We would certainly aim below that. We don't have a specific number below that. For the four system campuses, it's been more in the 1 to 1.5% range. And indeed, and particularly talking with those chancellors about what we were describing earlier, the challenges they've been having in their regional areas, you know, they feel in order to remain competitive on a tuition standpoint that they really need to make sure we keep those at minimal levels. We're still, as our Budget Director Vice President Tonneson mentioned, we're still early enough in the process that we don't fully know what we've even taken in for tuition this year yet. So we're not in a position yet to be very more specific than that. But we understand that, you know, with this kind of request that in future times before the committee, that we will indeed be more specific about what exactly those tuition levels would be.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then if we could get at another meeting, possibly a better breakdown as to how many employees that you have system-wide, like how many in each of the unions. And so typically, when we serve on the subcommittee on employee relations, we get a brief as far as how many are in each of the union contracts, whether it's SEIU or MAPE or whatever, how many individuals are in that, what is the across-the-board increases, what are the step increases, what are the changes in that contract, so on and so on and so on. And that's something, as many years as I've been on this committee, I've never heard from the University of Minnesota, but I think it's relevant, particularly when so much of the ask is directly related to the salaries. So I would hope that we would get some of that information. And any other way that you typically break it down to look at it, whether it's by campus, I know that our chair is interested in administration versus other staff versus faculty and so on and so on. So that would be a really helpful picture, I think, for all of us to see. And then the last thing that I would ask for is, I was just made aware of a portion of land, 3,400 acres, that will be given to Fond du Lac, even though the University of Minnesota had purchased it. So this is now a gift, and the value is approximately $25 million. And so if the ask to the legislature is $45 million, I have a question as to, can you explain more about that gift of 3,400 acres to the Fond du Lac tribe and approximate value of $25 million?
President Edinger.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, the Cloquet Forestry Center that you're describing honestly would probably require more of a presentation of its own, and we'd be happy to have a supplement of that in a future time. We're still in conversations with the tribe in that area in terms of what will become of the research itself and who will manage that and so forth, but we could provide that at a later date.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope so. It was something that the University of Minnesota had purchased in the past. It wasn't gifted by the tribe, and now you're gifting it back, and so I think it's relevant to this conversation. In particular, when I'm told that the value of that 3,400 acres is at least $25 million, maybe more. And if you're talking about a research portion, it could even be higher. But in any case, I would like more information about that, Mr. Chair, as they're asking us for $45 million more.
Budget Director Hassan, who do you have coming down?
With your indulgence, maybe we'll start with Faculty Liaison Donna Spanos-Martin.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Plowski and committee, for giving me the chance to speak to you today. I am Donna Spanos-Martin. I am the chair of the Medical Laboratory Sciences Department in the College of Pharmacy, and I'm also one of the two faculty legislative liaisons for the University of Minnesota. For those who don't know about medical laboratory sciences, it is the third largest healthcare profession, and it is our graduates who perform the laboratory testing in hospitals and clinics, such as determining which unit of blood is correctly matched for you, whether it's heartburn or a heart attack, what type of leukemia a patient has, what organism is causing the infection, and which antibiotics will be the most effective for treatment. It's one of the healthcare professions experiencing a severe workforce shortage. The University of Minnesota's Medical Laboratory Science Program is an undergraduate program that graduates the largest number of medical laboratory scientists in the state of Minnesota. As an undergraduate program, it is a gateway for first generation and underrepresented students into healthcare. We currently have a $3.2 million grant that provides these undergraduates with scholarships for up to $40,000 per year based on need. This grant only provides scholarships. It cannot be used for student laboratory supplies, which for some supplies, such as some of our microbiology plates, have had a cost increase of over 400% since the pandemic. We cannot, nor do we want to, increase tuition and laboratory fees to pass these costs on to the students. These costs greatly impact my budget and therefore affect my faculty. My very dedicated faculty deserve to be adequately compensated for the work they do. University programs like mine that help meet the critical needs of the people of Minnesota need adequate support from the state of Minnesota. Thank you. Question?
I don't see any questions, so we can move to the next person. President Ettinger.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I would like to ask up our student body president, Shashank Marali, to speak now.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Hi. Thank you, Chair Posky. My name is Shashank Marali. I am a fourth-year student here at the University of Minnesota and student body president for the Twin Cities campus. I'm willing to take any questions that anybody may have about the student perspectives.
I'm glad you started with a question, because I always have one when we have students. You don't need to answer this for privacy reasons, mm-hmm. but I keep a running total. Can you tell us what your debt would be upon graduation from the university? And I ask this of private colleges in Mid-State, so it isn't particular to one.
I've been lucky enough to receive substantial financial aid to be able to pay for my college tuition. So luckily, I won't be graduating with much student debt, which has been great for me.
What's not much? Can you articulate?
I would like to not specify if that's okay.
All right, that's okay. Representative North.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for being here, Mr. Shen. One of the challenges that we face with students is the housing. You know, we don't talk about the other cost, you know, the housing challenges. And we've seen what happened with the building that was not ready, the Identity Building in Dinkytown, that costed a lot of hardship for students. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say thank you to the students and also to the student legal services for stepping up. How do we really address that? Because I know that we don't talk about housing. At the same time, we're also looking for ways to address students and also residents to break their leases if the units are not ready through legislative process. So it's across the board, not only within the city. How do we really address those issues?
President Raleigh.
Yep, thank you for your question. Yes, it was definitely a disaster over there, and the university's student legal services team has been fantastic in helping students sort of fight those legal challenges and battles. And I think the best way to address these issues is to have more state policies to help better protect renters. If situations like this happen, they should be able to break their lease. They should be able to go somewhere else, find different types of housing, but instead they were stuck in that housing and had to find other accommodations, which made it difficult as the semester was starting. So I think better state policies to protect renters is the right way to go about this.
Representative Noor, anything else?
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Any other questions? Representative Cleaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here and for elevating the student voices. My question to you would be, what would be the biggest thing that you would want us to take away from your presence today? What are you hearing from students as the number one thing that we at the legislature can do to assist them?
President Morale.
Thank you. I think that basic needs is a huge issue on the university campus. Housing is just one aspect that students are suffering in. There is food insecurity. We live in a food desert, not affordable grocery stores nearby, and students need a way to get their groceries and live a healthy life. It's affecting their academics, and that's been pointed out in numerous surveys through the university and other places. And I think the university is doing a great job with some of their programs right now to help address some of those basic needs. But I think that there is always room to do more. And I think that funding is definitely required in order to help address those issues of basic needs, especially food insecurity and housing.
Representative Kleber?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's my question.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. President Morali, is that how I say it?
Yep, Morali.
Thank you for being here today. Last year, I think it was last year, there was a news article about the shortage of workers in the food services. Mm. And when I went to college, those were coveted jobs for students to work part-time in those jobs. Has that issue been resolved over there with the food services stuff? And if you could elaborate on any student involvement in those jobs.
President Morale.
Thank you for the question. I'm not entirely sure if the issue has been resolved. I think there have been some issues with student pay, which was resolved through an increase in student wages to $15 an hour, which I think has helped bring back a lot of students into working these student jobs, especially in the food service space. But I could not give you an exact answer as to if that issue has been solved as of now.
Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Knorr had a bill last year that dealt with the basic needs. If correct me if I'm wrong, but someone on staff or the president can tell us the amount, what it was for our basic need that we passed last year, and has that money contributed to any of the students' need for basic need?
Representative Knorr, do you want to answer that, or do you want to have the
Mr. Chair, we had designated a specific amount for institutions. I'd like to see if there was any funding. The EIPS program, the emergency EIPS program.
Budget Director Tonneson, do you want to respond? Budget Director Tonneson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, representatives, I'm not aware of, we did not receive a direct appropriation for that purpose, so I am not familiar with the legislation that you are referencing. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, does staff have any have that line item video item that we that did make it into the bill? Do you know?
I see the rulers are out, Representative. So we're looking for it now.
I got it.
Mr. Saber.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, there were two items related to emergency assistance for post-secondary students. There was a base increase in the 24 and 25 biennium of $6.5 million. To the Office of Higher Education for grants for campuses. And then there additionally was a policy proposal that was also had a financial component, which was the Student Basic Needs Working Group. That was a one-time appropriation to OHE of $44,000.
Representative McDonald, we're having the Office of Higher Ed do a presentation to us in the interim, too. They're going to have, they have several things they're going to do, and this could be one of them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well,
Representative McDonald.
Just on the surface, it seems surprising that with an appropriation of $6.5 million and an additional for basic needs, $44,000, that Ms. Tonneson wasn't aware of it, or the money didn't get there. So I think that's probably worth looking into.
I think
especially
before we say the money didn't get there, let's have the Office of Higher Ed tell us what happened.
Very good, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Seeing none, then I'm going to allow President Ettinger to sum up. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Robbins.
Is this our last chance to ask questions? I just didn't want to interrupt the student. I have a general question for the budget director.
Sure.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Budget Director Tonneson.
Thank you. So I understand there's a lot of outreach going back to the enrollment issue, trying to recruit students, both for Minnesota students to stay in the state and also for, you know, getting students from North Dakota, Iowa, what have you, to come to Minnesota. So my understanding is that four senior executives of the University of Minnesota are going on the mission, trade mission to Australia. And I find that concerning because it doesn't seem like it's the best use of money if the goal is to recruit students. That same money could be used to recruit students from the Midwest or surrounding states much more effectively than sending, the Myron Franz, the Vice President of Finance and Operations, Melissa Franson, the Executive Director of Government Relations, the Vice President of Research, and the, I can't read my own writing, but there's a fourth person, all going on a trade mission, four of the 35 people going. So can you explain where the money for that is coming from, how much that's costing, and how that fits into your budget priorities?
Budget Director Tonneson, if you don't have that information, we'll get it, but maybe you do.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not have that information right now. I don't know if President Interim President Ettinger wants to speak to the purpose of the trip, but I do not have the information on the budget impacts.
President Chair Pilowski and representatives, the fourth person would be our dean of our extension area, Bev Dorgan, and she's gone on prior things to work with colleagues that she has who do similar work in other areas. I know our vice president for research, Shashank Priya, has other engagements that he's going to be involved with in Australia with some of his peer organizations, but I don't have the specifics for you in terms of the cost. Like, we can provide that the next time.
Thank you. I appreciate that, because as we're really working to set priorities and you're coming back with another supplemental budget request, I mean, these are small items per se out of $45 million, but it really speaks to how are we prioritizing and making appropriate cuts and focusing on students versus other things that may be nice to have, but certainly are not a priority if the budget is this constrained. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I like Representative Robbins, didn't know if this is our last opportunity to speak or not.
We're running out of time.
Yeah, okay. So I'll try to be quick here. First of all, I just wanted to compliment the university, and I sent off some comments via email, but I really wanted to compliment the university. I had the honor of being present for the Stein lecture with Justice Amy Coney Barrett, and the way that the people that were disruptive in the balcony, I think the university handled it like it was a textbook example of letting them have a voice for a while, but not allowing them to disrupt the entire presentation. So I was very appreciative of that. With the events that took place on October 7th, what is come to my attention that really troubles me is a couple of the departments from the University of Minnesota and their statements regarding what took place and their condemnation of Israel for trying to simply retaliate for barbaric acts that took place that killed innocent Jewish families, entire families. In fact, one of these departments called it that Hamas fighters brought down border fences and launched an incursion into Israeli territory. It was a massacre. And one of the other statements, they're saying that the attacks, the retaliatory attacks, do not justify the horrific response of the Israel state and its defense forces. I would like to know if this happened on American soil, what we think would be appropriate retaliation. And so one of my questions is does the university stand behind these statements from these two groups? One is the Department of Cultural Studies and Comparative Literature, and also the Gender, Women, and Sexual Studies statement on Palestine.
President Ettinger.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, you know, something I'm learning heading into a university environment. I mean, there's a lot of voices in a university. Those of you who follow the newspaper on a regular basis, you'll see there'll be members of our faculty commenting potentially on either side of issues all the time. None of those are pre-approved by the university. None of those are necessarily sanctioned by the university, but it is part of their exercise of speech and their priorities. What I can tell you the university did in response is we put out a statement condemning the terrorist acts by Hamas that have occurred in Israel, and that's the university's position.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
And thank you for that. I just want to note that these two departments that put out these statements, they did so one on October 20th and one on October 16th, and I didn't see anything in the news where they came out on October 7th or 8th and condemn the actions that took place, killing Jewish citizens, innocent families, and babies. And I know Officer Clark or Chair, I forget his title.
Chief Clark,
thank you, has left now. But I'm wondering if there are any, if there's anything on campus that's being done right now to protect Jewish students on campus.
The chief had to leave. He told us in advance that he had another appointment. President Ettinger, you wish to respond?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I've had regular conversations with Chief Clark about, you know, potential protests, potential other events. Have met in person also with both Jewish students and Palestinian students, both of whom have expressed on a campus basis a concern about their personal welfare and about potential challenges and attacks. And indeed, that is probably the top priority for the university. I mean, it's a very complicated 1,000-year-old question, obviously, what's going on in the Middle East, but the notion of safety for our students on our campus is our, you know, is our business and is something that, so the chief is working on that. Any incidents that have had occurred, we've had requests from our Jewish students, for example, to have police officers present for their Shabbat dinners and so forth, and we do provide that.
Thank you.
Representative Robinson, we're getting close to the end.
Thank you. And this is more maybe for you, Mr. Chairman, than a specific question, but I was hoping we would also address where we stand with, since the Fairview merger with Sanford is not happening, and what's going on with the health system. So I hope we can have a future discussion on that.
I'll respond to that one. I have been in communication with Representative Liebling. We're not exactly sure what the recommendations will be from the task force. When we see those recommendations, there's apparently going to be some division of responsibility as to who should hear what. And Representative Liebling and I think that we both should have full access to all the information, particularly when it impacts the university's budget. So that's not a slated hearing yet, but it's a distinct possibility depending on those recommendations. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick final word since we're wrapping up. I wanted to just personally thank all of the regents that are here. This is refreshing. I know that we have a Regent Farnsworth on great occasions. Most occasions he's here. I appreciate that. And we've got some new regents. The ones that are still in the audience right now is Mary Turner, Penny Wheeler, and I know Kenyanya was there a little bit ago. And I, was there one more? One more. Oh, there we go. And I'm sorry. Oh, right, Robin Gully. I'm sorry. I didn't recognize you all the way back there. It's a long way back there. So anyway, I just wanted to personally acknowledge all of the regents. I think that's fantastic. I hope to see you more and even greater engagement with the legislature. So our doors are open and you're welcome to come at any time. Also, I wanted to encourage the president, as we talked privately about this, but I want to publicly encourage you again to have conversations with both County Attorneys Choi and Mariarty to really encourage them to take the crime seriously that's happening on your campus and near to protect the students. I think that that is absolutely essential. And that is something that we haven't had in the past, is a kind of a loud collective voice from the University of Minnesota to the justice system, whether it be the judges or the county attorneys, to take the crime seriously. So I really hope that that voice is loud, and a personal meeting, I think, with the president would be helpful. The last thing, President, you and I have talked about the Catholic students that were in the middle of quite a controversy up in Duluth, and they felt personally attacked for their because of their faith. And it has to do with the medical students and the transgender teaching there. And so I hope that that comes to a resolution where their faith is respected and that they are at least allowed to not have to take something if they don't want to because of their faith, or take a position because of their faith that counters their faith. So I know that's, it's outside of the purview here, but I just thought I'd take the opportunity to make sure that you know it's still on my radar, and I still want to have a conversation with those medical students that were offended and felt that their Catholic faith was attacked. So I want to bring that to your memory again, that I would really like to talk to them personally. With that, thank you, Mr. Chair, for holding this, and we collectively really appreciate that the time, the full 2 hours of time. So thank you, thank you, thank you, Mr. Chair.
President Ettinger, I'm going to give you the last word, and then I'm going to have the last word. So, President Ettinger.
Oh, again, I echo the thanks in terms of the opportunity for you to spend 2 hours talking with us about matters that are so important to our university. Really appreciative. I'll just do a couple quick. So I didn't get to your question earlier, Representative Scott, about the food service. I've been on campus at both Morris and Duluth and talked with them. Their numbers are up this year. It was kind of a post-COVID challenge that they were having in terms of getting the numbers. I'll check on the Twin Cities as well. And then in terms of your question, Representative Rarick, definitely have confirmed with our team at Duluth that our medical school will teach the procedures that are legally authorized procedures within our state, and no medical student is required to do something that is against their personal obligation. Well, that's consistent with how medical treatment has been done, not just at the university, but in the profession more broadly. And so we'll make sure that those things are both protected.
So, President Ettinger, I want to thank you, first of all, for participating in a two-hour hearing over the interim. This is extremely rare. I also want to thank your staff. There have been several meetings with the university on this presentation. The first meeting, we jettisoned 50% of what they wanted to present to focus on the budget, and I appreciate the fact that you continued to have that focus that was budget-related. That's going to be the theme of this committee. I want to thank the members, too. This is remarkable that we would have this level of interest and attendance at an interim meeting, and I'm hoping we continue it with the university, not only of Minnesota, but also with the MinState system. And then a little historic reminder. I'm very familiar with the supplemental budget bill of 2014. It was two sentences long. And with that, meeting is adjourned.